Hello, world. This is Allison Pipitone. In this podcast, we talk about music and those of us who do it for a song. Welcome to The Great Unsung. Well, ladles and jelly spoons, looks like we did it. This is my last episode of the first season of The Great Unsung. And it has been such an interesting, I wouldn't say journey, but experience. Yes, it has been such an interesting experience to learn how to do this, to reconnect with so many of my friends and to meet some new friends. It's been awesome. So, in this last episode, guess what? My friend, co-musician, a person with an inquisitive mind just like myself, Karen Taylor, is going to interview me. She's a singer. She plays the guitar. She played for 20 years in wedding bands. And currently, we are working on a little side project where we play in a cover band together. It's super fun. It's a great group of people. Okay, back to the podcast. She interviewed me for this, and she really she put me to task on a lot of things. She asked a lot of super interesting questions. So I hope you enjoy this. And again, thank you for being a part of this new experience. I'm taking a few months off only because I'm going to be recording with my band, and we, Allison Pipitone Band, are going to be playing a bunch of shows. And there you have it. So enjoy.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Karen Taylor, and I am here as the guest interviewer on The Great Unsung. And the reason why I'm the guest interviewer is because I am here to interview my very good friend and fellow artist, Allison Pipitone.
And by the way, you said, hey, Al, I've been listening to your podcast. Why doesn't someone interview you? And I go, really? And you go, yeah. And I said, well, why don't you do it?
Yeah, exactly. And I was honored to do it. But to me, you are one of the hardest working musicians that I know. Somebody who really, truly, even though through struggles, can make it as a musician. But however, you know, not only are you a songwriter and you work in your band, you also teach at the college.
Yes.
Too. But you, not only do you teach like English is, or not English is a new language, but you do the GEDs and stuff for students, but you've also taught numerous classes in songwriting for potential songwriters.
Correct. Yes.
So you work hard and you do a lot of solo gigs on top of it. Which, again, you're having to put your hand in so many different pots.
Yes.
To make it as a musician. I mean, sometimes do you ever just say, you know what, screw it, I'll write some songs at home, whatever, but I'm going to just go and work at the bank.
Well, yes. I actually said that for a long time. That's a long story, but I do feel like there is some validity to doing one thing. Now, this is sort of like the new America. I know so many people that have to wear 5, 6, 7, 10 different mm-hmm. hats. They have to have all these little piecemeal jobs in a creative industry or not, just because this is the way things are going. So one of my challenges for, as my decades go on, I'm 53 now, so like one of my challenges is staying open to changing with times and not becoming a wall that just ends up not doing anything to your benefit, right? So what I've been trying to figure out is how to do it in a way that I feel at peace and I feel like it's the right thing that I'm supposed to be doing, right?
Mm-hmm. It's like your authentic you.
Correct.
Because I think if you're doing things that are not, like, let's say, for instance, playing, let's say, in a cover band of music you don't like, but it makes you a lot of money. It's almost like you're like selling your soul to the devil.
Yeah.
What I mean? It's like you're doing something that's like sucking your energy, but not making you happy.
Yeah. And I think that has to be such an individual experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
I remember literally 1987 or something. I had this conversation with myself when I was thinking about going to it wasn't Berklee, but there was a guitar school in Hollywood. Okay. Oh, really? And it was a 2-year program, and I thought, you know what? I want to learn how to get good on the guitar. I'm going to go to school. But I said, no, I think that'll ruin it for me if all I do is practice the guitar and learn all the scales. Should I have done it? I don't know. I didn't do it. So like for 35, 40 years, I've had this conversation with myself, right? Mm-hmm. How do you find your authentic self? And I think that all of it stems from our culture and where our culture places value on music.
Yes. Isn't that really an amazing thing, too? Because pretty much people of all cultures, all economics, all classes, all ages and stuff, music is such an important part of their lives. You know, they're in the car, they're singing in the shower, whatever. It brings so much happiness, but yet musicians are not
happy.
they could be happy, but they're so undervalued and sold short very often.
Yeah.
Not paid well. Like, it's always like, oh, will you do it for free?
Yeah.
You know, doing music for free. But yet the amount of practice and the amount of time, and then just the labor intensive part of being a musician, of, you know, taking all your equipment, setting up, taking down, late nights, but it's not well compensated. And to me, it should be probably one of the highest paid jobs.
Because of the joy it brings to people, and
yes,
it's a destination. People gravitate towards music. Now,
right.
Yeah, I think I don't know, it reminds me that like in a lot of other cultures, well, if we're talking about certain countries in Europe that I know lots of people who have played there, and they all say how you're treated differently as a musician. You're not put up on a pedestal, which America tends to do, but you're valued as if you get paid, in other words, and people mm-hmm. are there and people listen. Now, for us, to have that be every show, we would be happy, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, but most places in the world, people don't try to do music for a living. America, a capitalist culture, we make this correlation between money and success. Do we make enough to live off our music? No. Like, if we haven't gotten a raise in 30 years and what we can expect from a bar gig or a club date, right?
If anything, it's gone down.
So I guess there's that, but I think on our end, at least for me, at some point I started to resent doing it because I was not making enough money. And then, luckily, more recently, I've gone even past that and I've said, wait a minute, this is not why I started doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's deeper than money. This, I don't know if you call it a gift or a vocation. I'm lucky that I'm able to do it at
Probably
all.
Both.
Well,
you could, not everybody has like the talent for songwriting. Like, that's not something that ever came naturally for me. I could try to start writing it and I come back to it. I didn't feel the same or didn't like it, and I could never really stay focused. But yet you've written, and you've had what, 9 albums?
Oh gosh,
now?
I published songs. Like, I've have 120 just published, but like, and I've written a lot more than that that are no good. So I've probably written, 500 songs, right?
Wow, that's a lot of music, and that, and several of those are some of my favorite songs.
That's awesome.
I mean, there are times where in the past I'll like text you, I'm like, I'm listening to this song right now, or whatever, like Long Long Ladder or Roller Derby Girls or whatever. And I really like your songs too, because they're like storytelling songs as well, which is, they kind of tell a little bit of a story of something. I'm not sure if they're necessarily about your life.
Right.
It could be just something you were inspired to write about.
Yeah.
But I know, like, Long Long Ladder, that was, you know, a song that was about your life, about a dog that you rescued.
My little Foxy. My 18 years I had that little sweetheart. Now listen, remember that I come from a literature background. My bachelor's and my master's are both in English literature. So I think in stories. I make sense of the world through stories, through fiction. And you're right. I mean, we mostly, when somebody writes fiction, there's a lot of themselves in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Songs are a form of fiction, and people can interpret them how they want, and they do. I know what I meant when I wrote it. Sometimes I don't, right? Mm-hmm. And one of my interviews with Tom Stahl, he was saying he barely ever knows what he's writing about. Like, he's just like, he plays with words. That's another fun thing to do, is play with words and how they sound and the rhythm and the texture mm-hmm. of them, right? So I love writing songs. That's the one thing that I love to do, even though it's very hard work, but I don't think it's good. It is good hard work. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Sort of like with your job, you're a physical therapist. And we've mm-hmm. had a lot of conversations recently about what does a job mean to us and what does our outlet mean to us, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And you have always wanted to do both.
Yes.
You love being a physical therapist.
Yes. And that definitely pays the bills, without a doubt. But the music thing, I just can't imagine having not done that in life. It was always something that I wanted to do. But I knew I wasn't going to be destined to be, you know, the next Whitney Houston or anything like that. And I didn't really want that. It's just that I wanted kind of like a balance in my life with that. What about you?
Well, I came from the background of, for many years, I liked the concept of being the struggling artist. I liked being poor. We lived in Hollywood, and the excitement and the sort of, there was something romantic about never having any money and just not, you know what I'm saying? There was some picture, like, you know, like, a cowboy has this idea of being lonely out in the desert and just has his horse and his saddle, right?
Right.
The musician for me had this sort of same sort of romantic characterization, like you did not know where your next dollar was coming from, literally.
And that wasn't scary to you?
Oh, I loved it. It was exciting. It was like being a cowboy. For many years, I liked it.
You know, I want to actually talk about this, since you did bring up Hollywood. Now, you were born and grew up in your earlier years in California, right?
Here. I was born here.
Oh, you were born here. Okay.
Yeah. I was born in Catskill, New York.
Oh, okay.
Four kids, my mom and dad. They were very young when they got married. It was the late 60s, early 70s, mid 70s. In 1974, I think, they got a divorce. I was, I think, in fourth grade. And the 70s were crazy, mm-hmm. as we all either have heard about or lived, right? Mm-hmm. And I lived it. And so my mother moved to California with us when I was in sixth grade. And then we had a custody battle, and we got split up. I was sent to San Diego. I you know, the thing was, good and bad, I loved both my parents, and I loved both the cities that we were living in. And it was from that point on, I had two lives.
Mm-hmm.
My one brother and two sisters, we were never together, all four of us, from the time I was in sixth grade until my first year of college.
Wow.
And so I grew up both places. If I went to school there, I had summer here. If I went to school here, I went there for the summer.
So when you say here, do you mean the Catskills?
I mean Buffalo.
Your father then moved into
suburbs of Buffalo, yes.
I got you. So now when you were young, and now your parents have gone through this divorce, were you already interested in music somewhat, or playing your first instrument at all, even in school?
Yeah, no, nothing in school. I took probably 2 or 3 months of guitar lessons when I was about, I don't know, seventh or eighth grade. And I had to learn Go Tell Aunt Rhody, and like I Gave My Love a Cherry, and then I couldn't read music, and I had to, I never could read music, and I still can't. And so I would always get stopped at this part where I would have to read music. So I quit that time, and I took it maybe once again when I was in high school. I never learned anything except, my dad had a guitar, and he played basic chords, D, G, E, A, B, right? So I was never a musician. I never learned how to play the guitar, got a guitar of my own until I was 18 years old,
mm-hmm.
when I moved out to Los Angeles to go to college out there. So I only can answer that by saying everything in our family, all the good times were associated with music. My dad and my mother both loved music. And I think that for them reflected the times they were in, like all of the student demonstrations and the civil rights movements, which my parents were a part of that whole thing. My dad was a young professor. My mom was a young student. And all this was happening, you know, the Kennedys and Martin Luther King and the, you know, my mom was tear gassed, you know. And
exciting times.
I guess so, but very unsettled.
Unsettled times.
And they divorced by the time they were, my mom was probably 32 years old when she took us and moved to California.
Oh, wow. So now, so you had started with the guitar in 7th, 8th grade. Once you had to start trying to read music, you dropped out and that. But right. I think it's very typical for younger people, like especially when they're forced to have to do homework, so to speak, to drop out of things.
Yes.
Much like my experience playing the violin. I didn't care for it. And it wasn't until later that my sister had said, "Do you want to take like a community course with me on the guitar?" I'm like, okay, you throw
and
her
what,
a bone.
What do you mean by later? How old?
Oh,
were you?
I was in college.
Okay,
sometime in college, and went in it. You know what? It just stuck with me then.
Did you already know you could sing?
Yeah. Oh, yes. From the time I was little, my mom was always singing constantly. I was in chorus and everything when I was a kid. Not in high school though. I wasn't. And so it really, but I still always sang. My twin sister and I used to like make our own radio programs or whatever.
Like on a cassette tape?
Yeah. And we always thought we had good voices. I mean,
what'd you do?
Well, geez, thank you very much. So we always kind of wanted to do that. And the whole idea of being in a band sounded really great to us and stuff. But it really wasn't until college that I was like almost towards the end of college that I even learned how to play the guitar. And I had taken piano lessons earlier, but with the guitar, I remember I learned all the chords and stuff. And I did know how to read some music and tab, but I am not a great guitar player at all. But I remember I just learned all the chord diagrams just so that I could play the guitar while I sang.
While you sang, right.
Because that was the main thing, was I wanted to perform and sing.
Yeah, so it had a function for you.
It had a function. So once I found that it was functional, that's when I got into it. Now, you said that...
Same thing with me.
You got the guitar at 18. What made you get the guitar at 18?
Well, my sister, Natalie, my sister Gabe's, my brother Damon. It was the first time we were all together since that time. And I don't even remember the conversation or how it happened, but we said, what should we do together? Let's start a band.
Really?
Yeah. And so my brother said, I'll play the drums. And I said, I'll play the guitar. I won't play electric guitar. And my sister Gabe said, I'll play the bass. And that's like, I already know how to play piano. I'll play the keyboards and I'll sing. All right. So we bought instruments on credit cards, another thing I'm not proud of, which I might still be paying off. No,
maybe.
So, and we started a band called the Monas, and we
It's a great name.
Yeah, and that really became my identity for many years. I loved college. I loved being a young person from the age of 18 to about 25, 26. That was great. I found what I was supposed to be, right? Studying literature by day and playing in like a punk rock band during the early 90s in Los Angeles. It was so fun.
Sounds fun. And so, all right, so you're with your, so you, all of you are learning how to play instruments.
Yeah, for the most part.
So you probably were sort of like garage band kind of comes to age. And that, did you, were you a cover band?
Oh, yeah. Well, here's one for you. Our first gig was at a Mormon dance. And, you know, Mormons don't drink, which is important when I tell you this next part of the story. It was a 3-hour gig, and we knew five songs. So we played those 5 songs for 3 hours.
Did they mind?
They danced. Almost made me want to turn Mormon. I'm like, how? That's so nice. How could people be so accepting, you know?
And they weren't drinking.
No.
Wow. But okay, well, good for you. I give you credit for that. But 5 songs for a 3-hour gig.
Listen, back then though, it was still like cool to have a live band somewhere. You know what I mean?
I suppose so. So you had 5 original songs.
No, 5 songs. They were a couple covers. I remember.
So 5 cover songs.
There was, I think, three originals and a couple covers. One of them was Summer of 69 by Bryan Adams. And one of them was You Better Be Good to Me by Tina Turner.
You Better Be Good to Me. I can't see you doing that one, but did you sing in this song?
No, I never sang. I just played guitar.
Natalie just sang? Yeah. That's so funny. I'm going to have to ask her to sing that for me. So how long did the Monos go on for?
So that was had to be 85 until maybe 94. So 9 years. By the end, my sister Gabe was 14 when we started. She dropped out quickly soon after because she was 14. And so my brother's buddy from high school, Aaron Britt, joined us and that became our band. And so we started really not knowing anything and probably being really bad. But what we did have was a lot of enthusiasm and we had a lot of big plans. And so we went through all the, we went through all the levels in Los Angeles in the club scene. We ended up with like 1 or 2 development deals. We were playing at the Roxy, the Whiskey, the Troubadour.
Wow. Those are some big clubs.
Oh, yeah, it was, we did a good job of climbing that ladder and we, had many, many, many very close calls. But as we were saying before we started this interview, spinning that wheel, what are your chances of making it, right?
Yeah.
I can say that we very well could have made it, but we didn't.
Do you feel as though that was the closest you came to making it big was living in LA and playing with the Monos?
I don't know. I don't know how to answer that because the whole idea of making it big never, I don't think it's, looking back, I don't think it's a good thing in a lot of ways. And were we that close? Oh, yeah, we were that close at that point. We had Tim Burton, who was at the time directing Batman 2. We had him have us in his office asking if he could direct our first video.
Wow.
And he was at Warner Brothers movies, and he had Warner Brothers Records interested in signing us because he wanted to make a video. Like, that's pretty close to the big time, don't you think?
That certainly is. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, why do you feel as though it's a bad thing?
I think now it would be, for me, a good thing. But I think back then I had so many personal issues I had to work through that if I had been exposed to a lot of success, financial, and if I had pressure, if I had like all the pressure that comes with being under a microscope, I honestly feel like I probably would have gotten into drugs or something and probably would have died or like some sort of a overdose. I know my personality and I know how I was back then, like super much more intense than I am even now.
Mm-hmm.
So now that I have the luxury of looking back, I guess I'm kind of happy we didn't make it big because I feel like there were so many there was a lot of bad forces out there that we got a little taste of that. I never did drugs, thank God, but I feel like under pressure, I might have turned to things that would have not been healthy for me. Do you know what I'm saying?
And certainly there's plenty of it out there.
Yeah.
And if you'd gotten into those scenes and those parties, it could have been dangerous for sure. So at that point now, after the Monos kind of had their time in the sun, is that when you decided to move to Buffalo for good?
Yes. I don't mind talking about this now, but what happened was I had a nervous breakdown.
Okay.
My sister had moved to Colorado, who was like my rock my whole life. And she had
Natalie. Okay.
And she had her little daughter, Devin, who I was like the light of my world. So she and her husband, they said, we're going to start a new life. We're moving to LA. Quit the band. Okay. That's when I started singing. Okay. Our manager died right before she moved. That's why the Tim Burton thing fell through, because our manager died of a cocaine overdose. I figured out I was gay, which in 1994 was a horrible thing to realize. Mm-hmm. Sad but true. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple other things, that the other personal things, the sort of the universe sort of like collided on me at that point, and I couldn't take it. So I remember talking to my grandma Donna, and she said, "Honey, why don't you just come home? I'll send you a plane ticket." And that word "home," I was like, "Oh, okay, I'm gonna come home." So I came back to Buffalo. I moved in with my dad back in Hamburg. His family had a young family with him, my little brothers and sisters, and I got accepted at UB Masters in History. And I started going to classes. And meanwhile, I was really struggling. I was having horrible panic attacks. Every little thing was so hard to do. I couldn't really hold down a job. I was literally crying half my life, okay? I was not focused, okay? But my family at that point sort of kept me up. So as what people, if people are lucky to have a good family, that's where they keep you alive, you know?
Yes.
So I'm liking history, but I'm not doing well, of course, because I'm not even right in my head. So
right.
I go to an open mic at Nietzsche's. My sister Gabe's goes, "Hey, I'll come to this open mic." I'm like, "Well, all right." I wrote three songs during my nervous breakdown. I wrote three cool songs, one of which was Residue, which
that was probably one of your first popular songs.
It was, yeah, it was my first popular song.
And so it was on that women's compilation album.
Yes,
I remember.
So I played the open mic, and Michael Meldrum says, "You're really good. I want to give you a spotless songwriter showcase." Really? Okay. So I'm like, "Oh, I got to write some more songs." Then Michael Meldrum says, "This guy Dale Anderson is starting a new record label. He just sort of parted ways with Ani DeFranco. He was her manager, and now he's starting a new label, and he's putting out a compilation album. Why don't you talk to him? Give him a demo, okay? Get a song on the demo, Residue." This DJ in Niagara Falls, Carrie Gray, his name was, starts playing my song. Regular rotation during the day. All of a sudden, boom, I get a record deal. I find musicians to play with, like literally calling a drum store and saying, "Is there a drummer there that wants to play on an album?" I record an album. I have a small label behind me. He's incentivized because he just wants to show that his Ani DeFranco thing wasn't just a one-shot deal, so he put some muscle behind me. My record charts on the Billboard college charts. I start touring a little bit. That was always a little hard for me because of my anxiety back in the day, but I had Debbie Claus with me, who was the most awesome. She worked as a personal manager, tour manager, everything. And so that started it. That started the whole thing.
Wow. I had no idea. And we've
really?
Known each other, what, 20 years?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that. So so that's fantastic. So then you're doing the open mics. You get the record, the radio spot, record deal,
mm-hmm.
and you start doing some shows locally. After that, first of all, when you were looking for musicians, did you find that Buffalo was very easy to find the people that were willing to help you?
Oh, yeah. You said the magic word, people willing to help you. It was so easy compared to Los Angeles, which is, we had a good thing going out there, but I was used to the struggle. I was used to getting into like everything being like being, you had to be up against something. You had to push, right?
Mm-hmm.
Buffalo was the opposite. In my perception back then, it was like, everybody's welcome. Let's all just jam. Like,
yeah.
Okay. So it was in that sense, so easy. And they say when things are sort of meant to be, the doors just open.
Yes.
And that's what happened in that case.
And that's a wonderful tribute to Buffalo. I've always found the same way, too. I don't think that there's the level of people competing with you, like if you're in L.A. or if you're in Nashville.
Yeah. Yes, you know? And no. Like, I do know, you know this, too. There's a lot of humans like to... So, humans sometimes feel better, feel good when they feel better than someone else. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people like to compare and put other people down. Like, I have certainly experienced a lot of that in my life here and there, but I've been here so long now. Like, the best advice Debbie Claus ever gave me, people were talking shit a little bit about me right in the beginning. She goes, Al, don't worry about it. The only competition you have is with yourself. From that day forward, I'm like, you know what? That's true. So I don't feel bad when someone else does good. Do you know what I mean? I'm happy for them. And that sort of is so freeing. You know what I'm saying? Like, so I think, yes, Buffalo is such a welcoming place. And it's just, there's so many talented people here. It's incredible.
I just feel like that we're seeing the lack of places that, like, offer live music. It seems them get taken down and not coming
up. Actually, that's true, too. Like, that's true.
It's like trying to find places as a band to play, you know, that's tough. It really is. Well,
what's your theory about that? Because I've got one.
Why don't you go first?
I'm going to oversaturated market. Now, because
oversaturated with musicians?
And every place started having live music. Okay, so you've got all these musicians who want to play out, and you've got all these places, coffee shops. I played in libraries, outdoor parks, dinner places. Like, every place thought it would be a good idea to have live music. And to me, that made the value of the product go down, music being the product, right? So now they're like, well, you know, I've got a this is a restaurant. I can't afford to pay you $700. And people are there to eat. They're not there to listen to music, but they expect music to be in the background. Mm-hmm. So the idea of a music club, if you could go hear live music in 10 different places in town, why would you go to that one place that has the big stage and the big lights and you have to pay $5 to get in and you just listen to music and drink a beer, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that's my complaint, is that I miss those music clubs.
Right. No. I agree with you, actually. So I wanted to kind of get back to you again, because this podcast is about you.
Sure, let's do that.
But I have first, more questions.
Wait, can we first pause this and get another beer?
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right.
Welcome back. Again, this is Karen Taylor interviewing the fabulous Allison Pipitone. Thanks for joining us.
That's a really good intro. I should have had you in every episode.
Hey, you know, shoulda, woulda.
You have a good talking voice. You had a radio show.
I did.
Say Something Saturdays.
That's
which was
right.
Very good. How long was it? Year?
Maybe we went 1 year. It was something like that. I like to listen to podcasts a lot. The 88.7 ones, and that if like Fresh Air.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, getting back to you.
Sure.
So, and thank you for being so candid on a lot of the questions that we've had. I want to get now to the point where now music seems to be making you happy, kind of pulling you out of this depression, anxiety.
Yeah.
Okay.
True.
So lead me through now. You have this song that was on the radio. You're doing some local performances. You have your first album out or just a few songs out?
First album out. Now, I have to remember back to the time, but everything happened really quickly. There were a lot of really fun events, public events happening back then, like Thursday at the Square, where like 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people would come, and
those were fun.
We got that every year, and
I used to see you at that, but it was before I knew you.
Really? Yep. And like Canal Side, where a lot of people would come, and we opened for more famous people like Joan Jett, and
I was there too.
Sass Jordan, and like a lot of the Canadian bands, like 5440, like a lot. So we got tons of really cool opportunities. It just happened really strangely that my name got out there. The print magazines were very powerful, like Art Voice. They would take my picture a lot. They would list all our shows. We had a lot of fans. So a lot of opportunities came to me like that. And then we toured regionally a lot. Like
we, now, let me ask you, because you're saying we. Who's we? Because it started off where you were just playing, but now you have a band together that's regular?
Yeah, first I had a really great band called the Cash Cows. We did, my third album was recorded in New York City because I had a manager in New York City. And we took a lot of trips down, driving down to record at different studios throughout the city. We had my manager and my label invested in a producer who was somewhat well-known. And we had like some, you know, players, some like well-known studio players play on it. And that was going to be the big push to try and get a major label. At one of my shows in New York, we're talking 1998 now, somebody came from Columbia Records, and she really liked us. And she signed me to a development deal. And so what that meant was she had to convince her bosses that they should sign us. And so to do that, she told me that she thought none of my albums, my first two albums, neither one really captured our live rock sound. She wanted us to sound more rock than we did on the albums, which I can see her point, because one thing I have never quite yet achieved is capturing a fully rock sound on an album. Okay? Mm-hmm. That's still one of my goals, is to get my band to sound like the real rock sound it's supposed to have, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, she said we never captured that, and I agreed with her. So she got a development deal. There was a $5,000 budget back then, and she hired a guy, a producer, who I won't say his name or his studio, but he worked with people like Nine Inch Nails and Black Crowes and things like that. And so she thought he could get the sound we wanted. All right, so I'm on board. Bring the band down. We had a budget. Each person in our band got $5 a day to live in New York City in that budget, and I'm not kidding. So we recorded three songs, I think. I didn't pick the songs. She picked the songs.
They were songs of yours
yes.
that she picked?
Yes. Okay. And the engineer / producer was horrible. He could not care less about us. He was stoned the entire time. He was having pot deliveries every few hours. No kidding. And like, I trusted the process, because who am I? We're talking about Columbia Records. We're talking about this famous, well-known producer. Mm-hmm. So it sounded like shit. 6 months later, when I've got my life on hold, 6 months later, they say, sorry, but we pass. We don't hear the hit song. Of course they didn't hear the hit song, because it sounded horrible. So that band, that was sort of like, I would have to say, the beginning of the end for that particular band, the Cash Cows. It's a long story, but that was crushing, right?
Yes.
So rejection is something you get very used to in this business, and you can deal with it. You get very comfortable with it, but there are some rejections that crush you more than others, right?
Sure.
So this one was really bad because, you know, just because. So I took some time off at that point. I took about 6 months, and I learned how to record. And I bought an 8-track digital recorder. I didn't know anything about what I was doing. I took a ton of time learning, and I recorded an album with sort of new players. And that led to the second iteration of my career, which is Graham House, who became my brother-in-law, plays guitar with me still to this day. And then Ray Hangen was my drummer for a little bit. He was married to my sister for my sister Gabe's for years, and now they're divorced, but he was my drummer for several years. Then Pat Shaughnessy.
Mm-hmm.
And so from 2001 until now, I have this band. And so through all of that, I mean, we've gone through so many experiences together, a few albums, and again, that Buffalo thing, just loaded with talent, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I forget what your beginning of your question was, but oh, the albums, right?
Right.
One album just sort of like, everyone just captures a moment in time, a year or two or 3 years of what my life was like then, right? So I remember that third album because it was in New York City, and it was like supposed to be once again the big time. And then it was very disappointing. And then so I had to recreate myself. I said, screw everybody. I'm going to trust myself. I'm going to make my own record. So that's when I made Shake It Around, which was actually a very popular record with like our fans, you know?
Sure.
And then, you know, it goes from there.
Well, you've had some really good albums, but I guess that like between like when you finish an album and then you do a bunch of shows, are you continuing to always like be writing the songs for the next album?
No, the whole world is so different now. Like, honestly, the music industry is completely different from that model. The old model was you write songs, you record an album, you tour. You write songs, you record another album, you tour, right?
Mm-hmm.
That virtually doesn't exist anymore. And I'm trying to grasp how to make it work for me.
Why doesn't exist anymore?
Well, because everyone can drop one song at a time. People don't buy physical things to listen
like
to
albums,
anymore.
CDs or anything.
Yeah. Touring is very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
The two things are not related. That cycle doesn't really exist anymore. There are people who make their living off of people listening to their music, and they don't even have a band. They don't tour. They just produce songs. They write them on their computer. They don't even play an instrument. There are people who make their livings by playing in like tribute bands or cover bands and all that. And everything is possible now. There's no one or two or three ways to do it.
But when you look about like how popular artists used to make their money, okay, versus now.
Mm-hmm.
Did popular artists used to make most of their money off of recordings, records, albums, CDs?
No. Now, there's a whole spectrum of what we call popular, right?
Mm-hmm.
And traditionally, throughout history, musicians, artists, singers have been screwed over by the powers that be. Mm-hmm. Whether it's the record label for many years, okay, let's say that. So how did they make their money? Well, the lucky ones, performances, and maybe for every record sold, they might get $1, right? So the record's being sold for $10, they get $1. So if they sell 1 million records, they make $1 million. There are royalties that could come in if they wrote the song, right?
Or if they're at like a movie or something.
Now, so if you're the Rolling Stones, literally, you can ask for $500,000 to have your song in a movie. But if you're not the Rolling Stones, the average is about $15,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're lucky enough to get a song in a movie, you're going to make, you know, 15 to 50 grand, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't usually get all that money. You have certain percentages go to certain other people, so you split it up. And so now a career in music is a whole pie. It's like performances, merch, streaming, sales, sometimes physical copies of sales, royalties, things like that. It all sort of adds up to an actual number.
Okay, because it seems like now you see like a lot of, especially artists from like the 80s and 90s. Like I just saw Glass Tiger a couple weeks ago. It just seems like a lot of them are touring again, like even Art Park mm-hmm. on the Tuesdays, like bands you haven't heard about in like so long are out there touring again.
Yeah, that's a good thing, right? Why is that? Well, because public interest, the pendulum swings. And I think, say, Glass Tiger, mm-hmm. they have the same fans they've always had, and they're not getting new fans, but their fans are in a different place in their life. Maybe they're retired, or maybe they have, you know what I'm saying? So, like, and that is a new interesting theory in music industry that I kind of like this. Some people say that you only need 1,000 fans to have a career. If you are smart about how you continue to make your musical decisions in your life and how you play shows and where you play them, those 1,000 people can assure you a career. Isn't that interesting?
That is interesting. I have never heard that before.
Yeah. It used to be like I have a friend who sold 250,000 CDs for Warner Brothers Records, and they dropped her because she didn't sell enough. They told her she had to sell 1 million to break even.
Wow.
So Imagine a world where selling 250,000 units is a failure, right?
Yeah. And especially when people don't buy that anymore.
Right.
You know, because there, it seems like a lot of like musicians, including yourself, now are readily accessible on Spotify.
Yeah. Streams. Like,
why don't you talk about that? Like how you got involved with that?
I didn't get, like, I'm really like scraping the tip of the iceberg. I do have to brush up. I have to get better about jumping in that stream. Okay. Stream, no pun intended, streaming, but you have to be more available everywhere. There's platforms, there's like companies that help you distribute. I'm with CD Baby and they distribute my music to like 30 different platforms. But think about this. When you would, if you're signed on a label, you get about $1 an album, right? If somebody downloads your song for $1, you get about 70 cents. If someone streams your song one time, you get 0.00026 cents. So you have to get about, if you get 10,000 streams, you get about $7.
Wow.
Okay? So this is what has created this new model for like streaming is where most people get their music from. Most people consume their music by streaming songs. But the numbers you have to get for it to be anything viable are incredible. So that's what people of my generation who grew up with that record, tour, sell model, we're trying to figure out what does that mean to us, right?
Right. I wonder if even younger artists aren't doing as well as the artists from back in the 70s and 80s, just due to the technology.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, if you're talking the 70s, and if you were in a band, even if you weren't a famous band, you could get $1,000 for a show. Because in your town, that was the only thing going on that night.
Right.
And you got such a good feedback and response from the people that you made it your business to get good at what you do. Right? Mm-hmm. So bands get better. They get another gig. They can actually live off of that. Right?
Right.
So there was that. And then in the 80s, the 90s, well, we both were in that whole field, the Lilith Fair thing. I played Lilith Fair. That was a big deal, yeah.
That's huge, yeah.
That was a big deal, and that was, like, at that time, unheard of. Like, the concert touring things where it would be, like, festivals.
Yes.
That's a whole other phenomenon that it made its... We saw that come and go. We're like, wow, festival. Oh, my gosh. All these great acts in one night. Oh, my God.
It was fantastic.
Right?
Really, truly.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've seen a lot of changes.
Yeah.
And what stays the same? I mean, to you, why do you still like performing music? Why do you still like listen, going to shows? What is? Tell me about both of those things.
Well, I don't enjoy it as much as I did years ago and stuff because performing, I just felt like it was becoming more labor intensive. The late nights.
Is that a function of you having been there, done that? Or is it a function of the outside changed? Or is it a function of you, the inside changed?
I think probably a combo of the inside has changed and been there, done that. I mean, because I've always been in cover bands, like, we've always been able to command better pay because of that, because most band bar owners and that usually want bands where people know their music and they can sing along with
them. Is that why cover bands are more popular in certain circuits? Because people want to know, they want to sing what they know?
Yeah, they want to sing what they know. And these are also songs that are, you know, have been written and are popular. A lot of people really like them and stuff. And so bar owners want that, where it's like if you have somebody who's doing music that's not well known, it's probably may not have as much of a pull and that. But I've always enjoyed doing cover music, so that's fine. If I just had to walk out on stage and perform, I would still be loving it. It's just all the background stuff that goes along with it, you know? And it's mostly just how intensive it is, and then the pressure to have to try to bring in people at late night shows,
yes.
and having to try to negotiate with bartender or bar owners or whatever for money. You know, when I was in a wedding band, we had an agent that did that for us, and that. But
sure, I get that. Like that does a lot to chip away at your love of something,
right?
Right?
Right. I mean, I still love music. I just.
Do you love singing?
Yes. And I performed for 20 years, but I kind of am like, now I'm like not so apt to want to necessarily be out all the time and spending all my weekends doing this. And
except for our new project that we have a cover band together.
But in this project, which is nice, is that you have your band, Natalie has your band in her own band, and Ron is on in another band and stuff, so it's not so like intense.
Yes,
you know, so it's a little looser of a feel, so it's working fine for me,
right?
And I like it. So
tell me about wedding band experiences. Tell me about if you could describe to the world what is it like to be a singer in a wedding band.
Well. That was actually great. It really was. It was fantastic because, you know, I'd be dressed up. I would go to these amazing parties and special events, the country clubs, and, you know, you would get fed. You were paid very well, very well, probably 3 to 4 times what I make in regular bands. And that it's just that your friends and family weren't there. Like, you didn't know these people.
Which is sometimes...
Right.
Fine.
So if you're at a wedding.
You're not committed. You're not.
Right. And a lot of times at the country club, so I felt like the hired help. But it was sort of glamorous. And but you were, again, playing music that was suitable for dancing. It was all dance music or what the couples wanted for their thing. So after 10 years, I got sick of it. And I had to miss a lot of events because I was working Fridays and Saturdays and always New Year's Eve. I was always gone on New Year's Eve, and that was the night that paid the most. But I really liked it. Mm-hmm. I loved it. But I had to move on after mm-hmm. a while. My twin sister had joined that project with me, but it had definitely run its course for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, but it's if you are willing to service the masses of what they want to hear, whether it's like, you know, play that funky music and Brick House and whatever, I will survive. And that if you're willing to do that, people are going to pay you some good money doing it. But are you kind of like risking your own happiness? So, but anyway, so coming now to current day Allison.
Current day Allison.
Yeah, well, your last album was put out.
A long time ago. I've been thinking about this. I think it was 5 years ago.
Are you thinking of doing another album?
I'm always thinking of doing another album.
What keeps you from moving forward with that?
Money, period. No, two things. Money, period. Time, period.
Yeah. Now, when you do, in terms of time, do you record it here at your studio here?
Well, I've done a few different ways. I think... For our next one, I would like us to be in a studio, at least for the drum tracks, drums and bass, right? And then a lot of times you can do guitars on your laptop. Okay. And then vocals, there's something to be said for doing vocals in a real studio with very expensive microphones. So,
do you ever find it really tiresome in that to be in a recording studio? Like, I think that it always sounded like, oh, how glamorous. I'm going to go in the recording studio. To me, there is nothing more boring.
Really?
Nothing.
So interesting. It
lasts all day and you're repeating things
over and over.
And then you are overanalyzing everything. And in a recording studio, you hear everything.
Yes.
It is so unforgiving.
Yes.
And that, so it has never been one of my favorite things to do.
Interesting. Isn't that the cool thing about music, of how many different spots we can take our joy from? I love being in the recording studio. I love that process. It gets, the challenge is to keep it, to keep the end result in mind, because there are so many options and there's so much you got to know when to say when. You have to know when to say, all right, that's enough. You pick good people to work with. The 8-hour day in a recording studio is my favorite kind of day.
Wow.
So,
well, maybe it's because you're playing your music, and I was not playing.
That's not true. Like, no, that's not, because when I produce other people's music, I love the process.
Well, that's great.
Sound, like manipulating sound, right?
So, yeah, it certainly is.
Yeah, isn't that interesting though? And for me, like, I like being on stage. When it's good, it's good. When you're on a big stage and people like you and you're giving off energy and they're giving it back, and then you give off more energy, and like when the band is good, there is nothing in the world like that.
Oh yeah. I agree with you.
But I don't think I was put on this earth to be on the stage. You know what I mean? I like writing songs. I like capturing an idea and then transforming it into a song. It's something that I'm proud of. And then that's really what I like doing.
Have you ever thought about writing music for other signed artists?
Yeah, sure. But again, that business is very oversaturated. Lots of people spend their whole life trying to do that. And my songs are not typical pop songs. They're not. They're kind of quirky. No one's going to listen to it and say, wow, that's a hit song.
Except for me. Because I like your songs a lot. No, because I'm wondering, like, you know, with different avenues with people who are musicians, maybe there's people who don't really want to be on the stage, but are gifted in songwriting and could do this kind of
work.
Yeah,
it's a craft. Yeah, that kind of craft, I don't know. I literally am open to a lot of options, but I mean, I would love to write a song for somebody else. But I do know that if I have to choose where I put my energy at this point, right?
So where would you like to put your energy?
I still want to put my energy into my own songs and my own band. Because that's the most rewarding, and I have not had a lot of time in the last 3 years to do that because I'm working so much at all the other jobs, and that's a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's the truth. Like, one of my goals is to stop, slow everything down so I can have time to read books again. For me, books generate ideas, literature, like image, stories. I've already lived so many stories. Like, I don't really need any more material. I just need to hunker down and grab out some stories and twist them in my own particular way and make it into a song, you know?
Yeah, no. So now, if you had to give advice to, let's say, the younger you, the 28, 29-year-old.
Oh, yes.
Allison, who's back in Buffalo.
Who's doing great.
Who's
very popular.
Yeah.
But anxious.
Right. Anxious. You're just starting. And there's lots of different avenues. You do have some past music behind you. But kind of the world's oyster. What advice would you give to
that
person?
Oh, my gosh. I would say relax. Enjoy it. Because it is fun. I would say, most importantly, trust yourself. You know what the hell you're doing. Don't be so afraid to be confident, right? I think part of that is being female in a very male-dominated industry. Being like a collaborative type person, and everyone has a lot of opinions, I really feel like I could have trusted my instincts instead of doing what I was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
Or doing things that made sense or a reasonable next step. Like, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I think that they say a lot of times that women a lot of times don't trust their instinct. And they say for survival in the world, you should. Because in the animal world, they trust their instinct.
Uh-huh.
You know, they don't second guess. Oh, well, maybe, you know, maybe that animal's not going to come and try to take my baby. No, they automatically go to what their instinct is. And
that,
then they attack.
That fucking animal's coming to take my
baby,
right?
But they stick with it. But us humans are different. And I'm not saying that there aren't men like this as well. It's not certainly women, but I think women tend to be maybe a little bit more forgiving. And, you know, they don't want to be looked at as crazy.
Yeah, we're brought up to doubt ourselves.
Yeah.
I think younger generations, like the millennials and on down, those girls are good. They're going to be just fine. And the young men are wonderful. Now there's these new realities that the young men and the young women, in my experience, are on much more equal footing. The world is getting better. I think my generation, we still had a lot of these things to deal with. It was commonplace for me to be propositioned, to be groped. You know what I'm saying?
Yep, I know exactly what
you're
saying.
And guess what we did about it? Nothing. And it's not because we just had to like get ourselves out of the situation, but we did not say, what are you doing? You know,
because we were more like property, and it was at the will of men or mm-hmm. at the whim of men, too. So, I mean, that's tough, but I wonder sometimes now with this generation, the amount of work it took to be a successful musician, even if you weren't signed, but to just the amount of hitting the pavement and really going to practice, trying to deal with people with how much money you're to get paid and stuff. Sometimes it's like the work ethic that is required to do this is painstaking sometimes. And I wonder, do a lot of younger people, do they have the will or the desire to do it, especially when maybe the payout's not so great?
In a strange way, that might be a good thing. Because guess what? It would weed out the people who really, really want to do it.
And classic rock will stay present rock. It'll never go away. But if you do think about that, it's like a lot of the music that has been out by younger artists, it's like further and fewer in between of the songs that really make it as like the mainstays that stay around for a long time.
So far as we know, and you're right, we don't know, but maybe that whole thing that we grew up with, classic rock, or and I was more like punk rock. That was my whole thing. But like, maybe that was just an anomaly. Maybe that just happened one time, because the music industry has always been an industry. Mm-hmm. Nobody cares. You know, just what's another industry, like the restaurant business, right? Like,
right.
You know, it's just like an industry. So if you're not producing something that makes money, nobody cares.
No, you're right. You're right. Well, it'll be interesting to kind of see what comes up. So I'll be excited to see kind of what your new, your new venture will be. I am happy to be playing in a project with you right now. This is very exciting because I thought I was going to hang up my coat after the last one ended, but you were probably the only person that could have gotten me to say yes, and here I am.
Well, I appreciate that because really it's going to be good. It is good for us right now. Right?
Yes, it's good. And I think it's always good to be performing. My love for performing is to make people happy and to keep the party going.
And my love is to keep my amplifier warmed up. I don't ever want it to go too cold.
I like that.
All right.
And on that note, we'll end today's podcast. And I thank you so much, Allison, for allowing me to interview you.
Thank you, Karen. I love you. You're a sweetheart.
Thank you.
All right. You think about that little number. Even though we're going to be on a hiatus for a few months, please continue to write to us at thegreatunsung@gmail.com, especially this. If you want to give me ideas for what to do in addition to what I've done, topics or people you want to hear from, please just write to us and let us know. I'm going to go through my thank you list right now. First of all, Shannon Furtak. Every week she's been like doing the web stuff and coming up with our titles and our descriptions. And that's a big job. And she's been doing a great job with it. So thank you, Shannon, for giving me the encouragement in the first place to take this idea on. And then all the guests I've had, I'm just looking at my list right now. We had, the first week was Shannon and me. Then I had Catherine Cook, Teresa Quinn, Mary Ramsey, Tom Naples, Susan Rosler, Walter Kemp III, Grace Stumberg, my sisters, Natalie Howes and Gabrielle Hangen. Episode 10 was Maria Sebastian. Then for 11, I was out in California, my brother Damon Pipitone. And 12, our friend George Schwint. Episode 13 was with Jamie Holka. 14, Robbie Takac. 15, George Scott. 16 was, don't tell me, was it Tom Stahl? That would be awesome if it was Tom because episode 16... to be continued. Episode 17, Pat Shaughnessy. 18 were my music industry students at Fredonia. And 19 were me and Karen. So by default, I'm going to go ahead and say that yes, episode 16 was Tom Stahl. That's right. And we talked about our dear friend, Michael Meldrum. All right. Thank you to all the people who let me interview them. Thank you to all the people who have been listening to this podcast. And I can tell you this much, there are people in the United States, it's most of our listeners, but we've also got people in the UK, we've got France, Germany, Australia, Netherlands, Hong Kong, Sweden, Japan, and a country called Unknown. And I wonder what that is. I don't know. Maybe it's North Korea and they're not allowed to say. I don't know. Regardless, once again, you guys, thanks for great fun. I will see you back very soon. Please continue to support us by sharing this podcast with your friends. Keep listening to my music, AllisonPipitone.com. I look forward to seeing you at some of our shows. And until next time, this is Allison Pipitone signing off from The Great Unsung.